Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations with Jeff Stein and Jean Meserve.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Jean Meserve. Welcome to another episode of Spy Talk.
Well, there's lots of news in our corner of the world again this week, per usual, including growing calls to treat the warming of the planet as a national security threat. In Asia, Taiwan confirmed U.S. Special Forces are conducting training missions on the island, and the Justice Department has announced new arrests and terror financing. You've got something along those lines this week, Jean.
That's right, Jeff. Tracking some terrorists and other kinds of bad guys has gotten a little bit more difficult, and you can blame the rise of cryptocurrency.
A lot of this world is still unregulated, and just like you've had in the past tax havens or pockets of places where money laundering is replete or shell companies are created, same thing here. You're going to have pockets of illicit activity, dark corners of this universe that are used by bad actors to access capital and money. And that becomes then a challenge for law enforcement.
Hear more from Juan Zarate, who after 9/11 led the U.S. government fight against terrorist financing and money laundering later in the show. Special bonus, Jeff, he includes a primer on exactly what cryptocurrency is for those of us who are struggling with the concept.
Yeah, I need that primer because I get lost in cryptocurrency. It's just not my thing. But I do know that it's a dangerous new channel of terror financing, and it's something that we're going to track from time to time over the coming months. Meanwhile, Chris Whipple, a longtime journalist and filmmaker, hit the publishing big time in 2017 with his book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. That was followed by The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. Reviewers called it required reading, a page turner, and so forth. Chris Buckley in the New York Times called it the best book about the CIA I have ever read. It's out this week in paperback. So I called up Chris Whipple at his home in New York. Welcome to Spy Talk. The subtitle of your book is How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. Is there an implication in there that CIA directors operate independently of the presidents that they work for, even that there may be a rogue agency?
Well, Jeff, first of all, great to be with you. You know, I've always said, and you probably heard me say before, that the CIA was once accused of being a rogue elephant, famously by Frank Church way back in the 70s, when all the scandals came shaking out of the closet. I've always felt that at least since the 70s, that the CIA has actually acted as a kind of check on rogue presidents. I mean, all you have to do is look at Richard Nixon and Dick Helms. You know, Helms was no angel and did all kinds of stuff he shouldn't have done for LBJ and Richard Nixon. But when at the end of the day, he stood up to Richard Nixon and refused to participate in the Watergate cover-up, thereby arguably bringing Nixon down. Now, you know, fast forward 50 years to Donald Trump and his first impeachment. I think there's a kind of an elegant symmetry there that guess who the whistleblower was who brought the Ukraine scandal to light? It was an anonymous CIA whistleblower. So I think that you can actually make the argument that CIA has tended to rein in rogue presidents and not the other way around.
Let's name some of the positives to start with in the ledger of the CIA. I think of one offhand, the development of the U-2 spy plane back in the 1950s and 60s. But there's also a lot of negatives. The overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, and of course, jumping way forward, misjudging the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, failure to stop the 9/11 attacks and so on. All of these things we're still paying a lot for. Where do you come out on the total ledger of CIA operations and spying?
Yeah, look, we could talk all day long and you know, into next week about the negatives of the CIA. There's no question about it, from the Bay of Pigs all the way up to and including Iraq. And you even have to ask the question, was the messy withdrawal from Afghanistan also an intelligence failure? I think it unquestionably was. So there's plenty of negative stuff to talk about. And but to me, what's fascinating about where we are today is that I have an interview with Bill Burns. I think it was the first interview he did as CIA director in the paperback edition of the Spy Masters, which is published this week. And Burns was interesting, I thought. And one of the things that is fascinating about Burns is that he feels much as Colin Powell felt about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and his role in selling it. Burns really regrets that as a diplomat, he did not push back harder and do something to prevent the Iraq war.
Yeah, I was struck by that also.
That keeps him up at night. That still bothers him. You have to hope that informs his approach to Joe Biden and his willingness to tell Joe Biden what he does not want to hear.
Well, I think so, too. I wrote a piece about that when he was nominated, saying that it gave me personally great comfort to know that there was at least one official who was accepting some blame for a huge mistake, a strategic mistake that's going to be with us a long time. And I haven't heard anyone else step forward and say, gee, I was really wrong about that. Colin Powell did to an extent. But otherwise, we haven't had a lot of accountability. So what else would you ascribe to Burns as assets in his personality that we can look forward to during his appointment?
You know, outsider directors have a very tough challenge. I mean, Kofor Black told me that whenever an outsider director comes into the CIA, it's like Scottish tribes greeting the English king. They're not always welcomed with open arms. But I think Burns is, as the consummate diplomat, was very smart the way he came in. He did not bring an entourage of sycophants the way others have done. Mm-hmm. Porter Goss comes to mind.
Yeah, that was a disaster.
And some others. So I think he was quite smart the way he came in. And one real advantage he has is that he was ambassador to Jordan, which is one of the busiest CIA stations in the world. Mm-hmm. Burns worked very closely with those guys. So he is no stranger both to the analysts and the covert operatives at the CIA. He knows the territory. And the other big plus he brings is a very good relationship with Joe Biden. He's known him for 25 years. I think they have a good relationship. And as I explain in the Spy Masters and I tell various stories that illustrate it, the CIA director commands an army of analysts, operatives, paramilitary warriors, and lethal drones. But if he does not have the ear of the president, the whole enterprise is for naught.
Absolutely. That brings up the question of insiders versus outsiders. With Burns, we've got kind of a hybrid because he's so familiar with CIA operations, as you pointed out. But what about the overview of long decades of CIA directors? We have these insiders, Richard Helms, Bob Gates, Bill Colby, Gina Haspel, the outsiders, James Schlesinger, Admiral Turner, the elder Bush, Leon Panetta, and Burns. Can you make any generalizations about who are the most effective outsiders, insiders, or does it depend mostly on the personality and their relationship with the president?
You know, it's no coincidence that Leon Panetta was the gold standard, not only as White House Chief of Staff, but also in the very top ranks of CIA directors. And the reason for that is that it has so much to do with what you bring to the job. And it has to do with being grounded, being able to tell the president hard truths, being familiar with the corridors of power, knowing how to deal with Congress and the White House. Leon Panetta had it all. George H.W. Bush had it all. He was an outsider, but he was very successful. There have been outsiders who were disastrous. Jim Schlesinger, you know, they almost didn't put his portrait up in the hall with all the other CIA directors for fear that somebody would take a hatchet to his portrait. And I think Stan Turner, you mentioned, came in and fired everybody left and right. They were disastrous.
And so when you talk about disastrous, Chris, what do you mean in terms of administration of the agency?
Well, they triggered almost full-scale rebellions in the ranks.
Right.
I think Schlesinger and Stan Turner. Stan Turner's one of his problems was, you know, the irony is that he was just a brilliant guy. I mean, he was ahead of Jimmy Carter in his class at Annapolis. He was brilliant. He had a chest full of medals, a four-star admiral. It seemed like a great choice. Turner was a guy who he didn't believe in human intelligence. He believed in satellites and gadgets and SIGINT and paid a heavy price for that, just in terms of, the morale at CIA. And of course, obviously, it didn't help him in the end with Desert One and the disaster in the desert outside Tehran.
Mm-hmm. So George Tenet wasn't helped by his long experience with CIA as a staff director of the Intelligence Committee. So the performance of CIA director has to be also judged on the accuracy of the intelligence he brings to the president. And standing by his guns with that intelligence. And George Tenet, you have to say, it was a big fail.
Well, Tenet was, in my mind, really a Shakespearean character. I mean, imagine on your watch, a CIA director having the walk up to 9/11, the attacks of 9/11, the invasion of Afghanistan, the CIA-led invasion, the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques and black sites, and all of that just a warm-up for the invasion of Iraq based on your flawed assessment that Iraq had WMDs. Mm-hmm. That was Tenet's tragic flaw. His real downfall was his inability to tell George W. Bush what he didn't want to hear when it came to Iraq. I would say that, again, in that infamous slam dunk meeting with George W. Bush, Tenet should have said, look, Mr. President, it's not there. We haven't got the case.
You've immersed yourself in CIA operations, CIA history, and the personalities of these directors. I think you've interviewed most, if not all, living CIA directors. You've had extraordinary access. Do you have any insight? This is well-trod ground, but do you have any insight on how Tenet went wrong on that major call that did absolutely affect the course of history?
I think I devote two chapters to Tenet in The Spy Masters, and I like to think that it's a more nuanced version of Tenet's story than is usually told. I think that the notion that Tenet and the CIA simply went along with Dick Cheney and the neocons and their made-up intelligence on Iraq is simplistic. I think that, but it and the, but there's no question that and there, you can find a lot of people at CIA who will tell you that Tenet believed the assessment that they delivered to George W. Bush. So it wasn't as, I don't think it was quite so simple as doing Dick Cheney's bidding. I think that on the other hand, it was a tragically flawed assessment. It was, you know, again, famously, the first version that Colin Powell was given was written by the vice president's office. Tenet and Colin Powell threw it out, went back to work. Powell insisted on having backup for every assertion he made. And yet at the end of the day, it was all BS, you know, yeah. It was based on. So I think that Tenet will tell you that in the case, in the infamous case of Curveball mm-hmm. was, as most of your listeners probably know, the dubious source who was in German custody, whom the CIA never interviewed, who said that there were all these vans were had biological weapons. And it was Tenet swears up and down that he was never told that Curveball was unreliable. But there were plenty of people at CIA who knew. So anyway.
I got to tell you, I drilled down into this intelligence and the process, the decision-making on WMD back in the day, like many other journalists on this beat did. And I was struck, you know, the findings that CIA made, they wouldn't have passed muster in a newsroom. An editor would have thrown that back in a reporter's face and said, you got to get better sources than this. You need corroboration. This is junk. And I've had CIA people, you know, formers mostly, call me up and say, why didn't you run a story on this and that? And I would joke, I'd say, unlike you guys, I need two sources telling me something. I mean,
right.
Very, very disturbing. Do you think Bill Burns, the new CIA director, Chris Whipple, do you think that he's going to improve the analytical product of the agency? Are you confident about that?
I'd like his chances. I mean, I think that Burns was very persuasive to me. Again, I have an interview with him in the paperback edition of the Spy Masters, and he was at least persuasive to me that one of his top priorities, if not his top priority, was to repair the damage done by Trump, the politicization of the intelligence community, or at least Trump's effort to politicize the agency. And, you know, I think Burns has no higher priority than to try to give the president straight information.
Do you think if Trump comes back, and there's a lot of fear that among intelligence professionals that the former president is going to make a comeback, and we now know a lot more about January 6th events and attempts to overthrow the legitimate election of President Biden, that he won't be shy the next time around about replacing intelligence chiefs with yes men and worse. Do you get any sense of how the CIA leadership would react to that?
I think it's a real risk. I think it's a very real threat that CIA needs to be thinking about, and not only the not only at Burns's level, but I really think in the wake of the damage that Trump did, I think there really should be more attention paid at this point to strengthening the independence of the inspectors general. I think there need to be stronger whistleblower protections. You know, it was really just kind of amazing that the anonymous CIA whistleblower who brought the charges that resulted in Trump's first impeachment, that he was never exposed or punished by Trump, who talked about this person committing treason, mm-hmm. Who talked about basically wanting to string this guy up. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really any protection in place. Gina Haspel, to her credit, and I criticize her for many other things in the book, But to her credit, I think she protected his confidentiality.
Gina Haspel was considered by many insiders as being too accommodating of Trump. For example, I have heard, it's been told to me, that she didn't jump on the Havana syndrome issue right away and aggressively pursue that, because that would have led to the doorstep of Vladimir Putin and the Russians. Do you agree with that assessment, that she was too accommodating of President Trump?
I do. I think that in many cases, you may recall that she went to one of his State of the Union speeches and was applauding many of his lines, which no CIA director has any business doing. I was told by a very, very high-ranking White House official, Trump official, that Gina loves killing terrorists, and she's really good at it. And one of the cases that again has had really insufficient attention was the lethal drone strike on the Iranian general Soleimani in January of 2020. I don't have to tell you, for decades, the CIA has been prohibited from assassinating foreign leaders through executive orders of 12333, among others. They've always felt that was a bridge too far. And yet Gina Haspel accommodated Trump and thereby really, frankly, putting a target on every American official as well. There are reasons why that prohibition has been in place, and it was ignored. So I think there are a number of cases where I think Gina Haspel was too accommodating to Trump.
Was there anything that surprised you in your research for your book?
I think the extent to which the CIA is, the CIA director is the person we depend on to prevent another Pearl Harbor, 9/11, and even a lethal pandemic. I mean, it's hard to overstate the importance of the position. You know, we have a director of national intelligence now who is Bill Burns' nominal superior, Avril Haines, and by all accounts, they have a good relationship. And the DNI, of course, does the president's daily brief with lots of input from the CIA. But to me, the DCIA, as he is now called, the director of of the agency, is still the importance of that position is hard to overstate for better and worse. Without John McCone, the Cuban Missile Crisis might have ended very differently. And without George Tenet, we might not have gone to war with Iraq. Mm-hmm. Those are the stakes.
Yeah, and we've got some big stakes coming up in terms of the growing tension with China over Taiwan and other issues. And we can only hope that Bill Burns and his agency gets it right when that crunch time comes. Anyway, Chris Whipple, thanks for being on Spy Talk. It's always great to talk to you. You're the go-to guy on current CIA leadership. We'll be back talking to you again real soon, I'm sure.
Great to be back. Thanks, Jeff.
That's Chris Whipple. The Spy Masters is out this week in paperback.
Listening to him, Jeff, it struck me that the leadership qualities you need to head up the CIA really aren't all that different from the leadership qualities you need for any organization, right? A great resume isn't always enough.
That's right. You got to have good relations with the boss. And for the CIA, the boss is the president. If you don't have the president's ear, you're not going to function very well. There was a joke that went around about a former CIA director who could never get a meeting with President Bill Clinton. And when a plane crashed, a light plane crashed on the White House grounds, they said that was him trying to get a meeting with Clinton. So right now, however, it seems that Bill Burns, the current CIA director, has a longstanding and good and close relationship with President Biden. So that augurs well, at least for him and the CIA.
Coming up, we're going to talk cryptocurrency. Stay with us. Welcome back. The mantra for investigators of all kinds of skullduggery has been follow the money, because the cash trail often leads directly to culprits. But increasingly, hard currency is being replaced by cryptocurrency, and that is posing challenges because crypto transactions bypass the banking system and its controls. I called up Juan Zarate of K2 Integrity to talk about it. He was Deputy National Security Advisor in the George W. Bush administration, and before that was the first ever Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Terrorist Financing and Financial Crime, leading some of the largest asset recovery operations in history. Cryptocurrency, I have to admit, is a bit mystifying to me, so I asked Zarate first for an explainer. Crypto for dummies.
Think of this as a kind of railroad system connecting different computers that allow for the movement and exchange of tokens. And what can be a token can be anything. It can be a currency like a Bitcoin or Ethereum, but it can also be a smart contract. It can be something like an NFT, a piece of artwork, right? So in thinking about the crypto universe, you have to think about sort of the things that create crypto, which are the computers and the calculations, the railroad of that system, and then the tokens on it. And again, what has been most in the news in recent years is really how to think about cryptocurrency, which is the movement of value as tokens on this rail system that can then be validated in the context of that system, is decentralized, and is really driven by the calculations of the computers that are both mining, creating these tokens, as well as then trading them and validating them.
So people like myself see individuals creating these new tokens apparently out of thin air and ask, is this just funny money?
Yes, I mean, it's a great question, because there is a proliferation of both the tokens, the cryptocurrencies, other tokens, other things on the rails. And so there's a sense of, this is a little bit of, the tulip craze from centuries ago. And so it is a good question. I think the debate underway right now is, do these currencies represent real value? Are they backed by things that have value other than the computational value and the trading that goes along with these cryptos? And do they form part of a new market, a new part of the financial system? And I think some of this is answered by the markets themselves. You know, what is truly valuable? What is truly backed? Like these stable coins, which are backed by, let's say, the US dollar or another fiat currency. Or is it valued because of what people are willing to trade? And at the end of the day, the question of value is really determined by whether or not people value these things, whether that they're usable, whether or not they're adopted. And I think that's really, we're right in the middle of that debate. And it's a great question you ask, because the markets, the regulators, and others are trying to answer that question as we speak.
So China, I understand, has banned mining and trading. What do they know that we don't?
Well, what's fascinating here, Gene, is China's had a schizophrenic sort of reaction and relationship to crypto. That is to say, they've had periods where they've been very open to it. They've had a concentration of Bitcoin mining. You know, this is where the sort of computer farms that are generating the computational power that's required to mine, to create the Bitcoin, and to validate the trading and the rest. They've talked about having a digital renminbi, creating their own cryptocurrency, and they've gone through different stages where they've allowed it, not allowed it. At the end of the day, Gene, I think what they've done is predictable, because the Chinese don't like systems or elements of power, whether it's financial or otherwise, that are outside of central control. And so they're very much willing, I think, to think about a digital currency that the state creates and controls. They have trouble, I think, thinking about how they control and regulate a decentralized system that is not just outside their control within China, but outside of the normal rails and controls of the financial system. And so for a centralized autocratic country, you know, it makes sense to not really like or perhaps even to ban crypto because it is decentralized, it's open. Many in the crypto universe would argue this is the democratization of finance, allowing peer-to-peer transactions, people to control their finance, not reliant on central banks or you know, big stodgy financial institutions. So in some ways, the Chinese reaction is somewhat predictable. They don't like what they can't control. And this is a highly decentralized model of finance.
So you, for many years, were tracking bad guys, specifically terrorists, by looking at their finances. So there are rules and regulations around banking, which allow you to see transactions and follow the money. Are there rules and regulations like that around crypto? Or does it cripple efforts like the ones that you mounted against terrorist organizations?
There's a lot to unpack there, Gene. Great questions. I think the answer to the first, are there rules, regulations? The answer is yes and no. And I'll explain that in a second. And the answer to whether or not it cripples efforts, I would say no, but with a caveat. So let me try to explain what I mean by all that. There are three real big policy and regulatory concerns with the crypto universe, especially now that we've crossed the Rubicon of legitimacy, right? We now have, you know, the regulators not just accepting, but allowing for trading and adoption of crypto in a variety of ways in the formal financial system. So because of that, there are three issues that really regulators are worried about. One is safety and soundness issues, right? Is there systemic risk to the, you know, having the crypto economy, you know, exposed into and through the financial system? Can it crash the system, right? That's one way of saying it. So that's one issue. The second is consumer fraud. And you saw this, remember the Mt. Gox case where people lost, you know, millions of dollars because there was fraud in Mt. Gox. It was a crypto holding company. And it kind of went away overnight, right? So there's a fraud and consumer protection issue. And then there's the issue you're raising, which is, does crypto give access to capital to those who would otherwise not have access to capital? Because what we've tried to do in our world for years now, post 9/11, is can you make it harder, costlier, and riskier for bad people to raise and move money around the world? That was the strategy. And the more you can constrain their access to capital, constrain their reach in the financial and commercial system, the more you can constrict their strategic capabilities, right? That was what we were doing, or at least trying to. What you have now is a question of, well, does crypto give the bad guys access to things that they would otherwise not have? In ransomware, for example, the vast bulk of payments are in crypto. And so are you making it easier for bad guys to hold data and systems hostage?
Are you?
So it's a legitimate question. Well, I think yes and no. And I think the challenge here is that crypto is a new avenue for acquiring value, moving value, storing value. So that means you have to regulate it. You have to figure out, are there legitimate uses? And there are. And how do the regulations that have applied in the formal system apply then in the crypto environment? And that's where we are. We are in a place where some of those regulations are being applied. So for example, virtual asset service providers like Circle or Coinbase, to which I've been an advisor for many years, have to register as a money service business, and they have to have anti-money laundering controls, and they have to know their clients that hold wallets and accounts on their platform. But there are elements of that system that are still unformed and still in formation. So for example, there's this issue of unhosted wallets. So what happens if there's a wallet that isn't centralized in one of these VASPs, so to speak? What regulations apply to transfers and transactions that come in and out of there? That is still in formation in the US and around the world. So
right now they can move big sums of money across borders without being detected, right?
Yes and no. To the extent that they are moving big amounts through centralized platforms like a Circle, like a Coinbase that are regulated, that gets tracked, that gets reported. Those are institutions that are doing what normal banks do, which is file suspicious activity reports and bad accounts.
But they can just go to one of those others, right? Stay away from the regulated ones. It doesn't sound like it's a very hard thing to do.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's the challenge of the system, which is it's decentralized. So not as much of it is centralized through, let's say, dollar clearing banks in the formal financial system. So that's one problem. The other problem is a lot of this world is still unregulated. And just like you've had in the past tax havens or pockets of places where money laundering is replete or shell companies are created, same thing here. You're going to have pockets of illicit activity, dark corners of this universe that are used by bad actors to access capital and money. And that becomes then a challenge for law enforcement. It goes back to your second question, which is, does this make it harder for law enforcement? It does and it doesn't. It does to the extent that there are these movements that are decentralized, not as easily traceable. On the other hand, there are elements of the blockchain, the open ledger systems that are used that are highly traceable. So this explains why in the Colonial Pipeline ransomware payment context, US authorities were actually able to identify the wallet and then take back most of that payment.
But that was one instance where they've been able to do that. I haven't heard of any others.
Well, I think some is done quietly. Some, I think we're in a point, Gene, where we haven't been as proactive as we can be in that regard, both with the private sector and with authorities. But I think you're going to see more and more of that, in part because their tools exist to be able to trace and track. And I think we're getting better public-private partnership to try to do exactly what happened in the Colonial Pipeline context.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that a lot of these people who have wallets are anonymous. And so even though you might be able to see where the money's going, you might not know to whom it is going. Am I right?
That's right. So part of the challenge here is there are elements of anonymity in the system. So anonymity as to who may hold the wallet. Now, again, that's very different if it's centralized, if it's in a virtual asset service provider or a PayPal account. Those institutions are going to know who the customer is. So you and I can have a wallet, but we're going to have to give them our information. But if you have an unhosted wallet or other platforms that aren't requesting that in unregulated sectors or jurisdictions, you're not going to get that. But the other problem, Gene, it goes to your earlier point, there are other kinds of cryptocurrencies like privacy coins that embed greater anonymity, even more so than Bitcoin or Ethereum. This is why what we're starting to see with not just ransomware, but with terrorist financing potentially, is that groups gravitate more towards some of these coins or some of these platforms. Monero, for example, is a cryptocurrency that you've seen reported on that illicit actors prefer because it's harder for authorities to determine who owns or controls that behind the scenes.
You mentioned terrorists. Is there evidence that terrorists or extremists are using Bitcoin now?
Certainly,
I should say crypto.
No, we've certainly seen evidence of terrorist groups, extremist groups flirting with it, right? And having, for example, donation campaigns earmarked in crypto and beginnings of flirtation. But it hasn't been in mass. It hasn't been, hasn't become predominant. And to date, at least, it's not the way that those kinds of groups raise or move money. It might be, right? And I think this is something authorities have to watch, and they are. I think the bigger problem right now, Gene, is countries like North Korea. Evading sanctions. They've been cut off from elements of the financial system. I think we've done a fairly strong job of that. The problem, of course, is they've not only beefed up their cyber capabilities for offensive and defensive purposes, but they've figured out that this domain, this digital payment domain, so to speak, is an arena where they can profit. They can do so by hiding their hand, and they can do it pretty regularly and quickly. You know, the UN reported last year that the crypto heists and the hacking and the other activities the North Koreans have been involved in has profited them by about $2 billion. So this is a major source of revenue for a rogue regime, which has to be a concern for the United States and other countries.
Anyone, any other countries besides North Korea doing this successfully at the moment that you're aware of?
Not as successfully. I think what you have is countries like China, Russia, Iran that are used to using proxies for a variety of reasons. Flirting with different groups, organized crime elements, and hackers to then influence and operate in this domain. Largely, you've seen this, Gene, you know this better than anyone else. You've seen this in the cyber domain, where cyber attacks and other cyber activity has often happened through proxies, one, two steps removed from the central authorities of those countries. I think you're probably starting to see elements of flirtation in the crypto domain. We've certainly seen that reported with the Russians, with some of their influence operations, where they were leveraging payment through crypto as a way of trying to hide their hand.
The Department of Justice has now formed a national cryptocurrency enforcement team. What do you think? Is it enough?
It's good. It's not going to be enough. I think this domain has to be seen like we've seen other domains of the financial system, mixed with a little bit of trying to manage the internet, right? So it's a part of the financial system. It's partly the internet's half man, half beast, if you will. And I think we have to not only figure out how to regulate it best, right? Not a one size fits all, but how do you regulate this in a way that recognizes the advantages of the technology, but also some of the vulnerabilities, and then building systems and enforcement capabilities, knowledge all around this ecosystem, which means you've got to have enforcement. You've got to have, you know, 1811s and analysts in the US government who are trained in this space. You've got to have new models of public-private cooperation with the legitimate VASP that are trying to cooperate with the government. This has to be kind of a whole paradigmatic shift toward managing this, precisely because we're not going back, right? We've crossed the Rubicon. The crypto economy is with us now. Now we have to recognize that there's risk, there's vulnerabilities like any other part of the system. And we now have to attack it and address it the way we would any other vulnerability.
Presumably, we need some sort of international approach to this. It isn't just an American issue. Congress and the agencies can't just set rules and regulations on this and expect to deal with it effectively.
You're right. And I think you're going to see that in a couple of different domains. I think central banks, which themselves are flirting with issuing crypto, right? Central bank digital currencies, some of which are already out there. Bahamas has their sand dollar pilot, and you've got other countries that are in latter stages of their exploration. So you're gonna have central banks formulating rules of the road and parameters for how central bank digital currencies operate. You are also seeing in the G20, the G7 discussions around how to regulate them writ large. And then in organizations like the Financial Action Task Force, which sets the standards for anti-money laundering, countering terrorist financing around the world, already putting out guidance, interpretive notes around how to think about the application of anti-money laundering rules, counter-proliferation finance rules, et cetera, into the crypto environment. The interesting part of all this, Gene, a little bit of the scary part too, is this is all in formation.
But in the meantime, a lot of illegal activity and nefarious activities taking place.
You've had authorities worried about this, working on these issues and trying to work with industry to figure out how to get to these potential problems. But it's not easy. And Gene, to your earlier point, there are parts of this universe, parts of the global environment that aren't doing a good enough job, that aren't regulating well enough, and where you're going to have dark corners of this universe operating, which then need to be attacked.
That was Juan Zarate, former Deputy National Security Advisor for President Bush and now a global co-managing partner for K2 Integrity. Well, Jeff, do you understand crypto now?
A lot better, thanks. You know, you and I have both talked with Juan Zarate for a long time now, since shortly after 9/11, when he played a key role in the Bush administration in getting terror financing tracking off the ground. It was pretty new field at that point, although, you know, we had followed the money before, but we really started to clamp down on it after 9/11. I was fascinated by these allusions to the tulip bubble. If you remember in school, there was a 17th century speculation bubble over tulips, of all things, and it crashed. And prognosticators keep thinking that the cryptocurrency market is going to crash sometime soon. But in the meantime, it's like dark money in politics, isn't it? It's hard to trace, but it is traceable. And it's clear that national security officials have got their eyes on it.
Well, as he mentioned, he thinks we've passed the Rubicon here. You know, it really is an alternative financial world that some people project in 10 or 20 years is really going to be dominant, that all assets are going to be digital. I read some statistics recently that globally 220 million people are already using cryptocurrencies.
Good Lord, those could be my neighbors. I don't even know about it. So maybe I should take another look at it. I guess you can make a fortune if you bet right on it. Anyway, that's another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. We're new here at MSW Media. We're happy to be here. I hope you'll come back and join us again next week. I'm Jeff Stein.
And a reminder, you can subscribe to Spy Talk on Substack. I'm Gene Meserve. Have a great week.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.